Well, this is a good idea after numerous congratulatory champagnes, and I get a phone call while I'm in the shower. We need to go to dinner right now. I get to the hotel bar. If only I can remember what hotel we're in.
Hotel New Roblin.
With accent. And the guys are drinking two different versions of whiskey. We've got a Scottish single malt, and we have
an American bourbon.
Why not drink what you are familiar and favourites of? What's happened today? What do you talk about? Introduce yourself with your Twitter name, please.
My name's Wilsh on Twitter, Willsh, or John V. Wilshire. I talked about making things people want rather than making people want things. So just that switching energy from all the creativity being on the outside of places that are making products and services to being on the inside and being part of an integral thing that comes out the end.
You caught me by surprise today when I was talking about having a pair of trousers that had a tagged history, a digital story that connected to my trousers, my Hyatt jeans. And I said, who's wearing jeans in the room? And everybody, you know, loads of people put their hands up, and then whose jeans have got a blog? And then you put your hand up. I was like, you bastard. I had no idea you were wearing the same trousers as me.
I kind of ruined that for you.
No, it was good because it was showing to me an evolution of stories connected to items of clothing in the form of a blog. This will happen.
Yeah, I think it's...
is happening now.
It is happening now, and I think it's sort of like where it goes next is the interesting thing, because it's kind of like, sort of like, is it just another network, but a different sort of network? Or sort of like, some social networks grow and some then die, but then some sort of like take and stuff. When they're connected to products and things, actually do they take on a different sort of life? Are they around for a lot longer because people own the things for longer? It's no longer just an attention span thing. So I think it'll be interesting seeing how the network grows, but also how the jeans company grows by actually attaching it to something that people buy. It's a different sort of business model for a network. Are they really a jeans company or actually a network company?
I'm interested in the assumed value, the whole, you know, how long are you going to be keeping the story going? Does it matter because you've got an item of clothing that has something attached to it, ethereal or not, that somebody else's jeans don't? And it kind of gives you an element of ownership. Introductions and thoughts on this?
Ah, well, I'm reprising my previous visit. This is Jordan Berkowitz, at Jordan Berkowitz. I'm really complicating things for people. You know, the question that really comes to mind is whether or not the object will continue to survive. I think that, you know, the kind of obvious reality is that we can ascribe value to it. We, the owners of these objects, which now suddenly have lives on the Internet of Things, you know, have a story associated with them. But I think we're speculating. I suspect it's the latter. I suspect that these objects, after they've kind of served their initial purpose, will become something else. And the unfortunate reality is that in most situations, the stories will end because the barcode associated with your jeans will somehow become disintermediated from it. And, you know, then suddenly the story ends, though the object continues to serve some purpose. I don't know how we stop that kind of break.
Open source.
Open source what?
Well, the ability to tag anything to anything and have that float across platform. I think that we're polluted with thinking that every internet interaction we have has to be a part of a larger business model, when ultimately we need to be savoring what is our cultural history tied to digital objects.
I agree, but do you believe that your genes are going to survive you?
Do you know what? I've inherited clothing from people who are dead.
Okay.
So it's likely.
I appreciate the idea that we should be, well, there's two sides to that.
Not that I go around wearing dead people's clothes all the time, but there are some places.
But I do think there's two important ideas associated with that. One is that we should be crafting items with the belief that they should survive longer than us. I think craftsmanship is something we need to revisit. And I think as we think about, you were talking about reshoring, you know, about bringing manufacturing back, I think inherently what comes with that is more of a respect for craft and the desire to create things which are not disposable. possible. I think the second piece of that, which is important, is thinking about you know, kind of perpetuation. And if there is the potential for us to create items that we believe will survive us, there's a burden of choice and a burden of kind of continuation, which you think about something differently if when you buy it, the intention is that you're actually not buying it for yourself, but you're buying it for those who come after you.
You're investing in a future.
Exactly. And the difference is, are you investing in a future for the object, or are you investing in a future for the people who will inherit that object?
If I feel that I'm investing in the ability to have an element of immortality through the objects I come into contact with, that's a value that I don't think people, you know, who's going to write a novel? Who's going to attach their life to their clothing or object that they exist with, and then that carry on after them? Wouldn't it be amazing to be able to pick up objects in antique shops and automatically know who these hands have passed through?
Well, I think it's sort of like, the thing that it sort of like spurs in my head is sort of like, none of the technology we have is suitable for adding that story and data to things. So it's all stuff that's come out of manufacturing. It's all RFID and QR code that was read by robots who were pretty much dealing with the same static things as they went through. But if more of the, and Hyatt Jeans is one example of many, but if more of that sort of stuff takes off, people will start going, well, you know what you need? You need a golden thread. It's one golden thread that you can stitch into any item of clothing that is readable by any device. And I think it will sort of, it will start...
Someone will want the trademark. Someone will want the patent to that. That's why these patents and trademarks are dangerous.
Yeah, and so therefore they will invent it and they'll have the patent for so long, and then it'll follow a patent and then everyone will use it. It's like one of my favourite... My favourite open APIs is the Ferguson 3-point link system.
Well,
please explain.
Why am I intrigued in such a boring sounding title? The Ferguson 3-point system. Isn't that a sexual position?
Or the 6-point exploding heart technique?
Exactly. It's all of those things and more. No, what it is the thing on the back of tractors.
The engagement system.
Oh. Yeah. So
it's sort of the drivetrain to the object.
Massey Ferguson invented that.
Yes, exactly.
Coventry.
Yes. And suddenly, but when it fell, when it fell out of patent, when it fell so that anyone could use it, suddenly everyone thought, well, I'll just build stuff for that patent so that all my stuff can go in the back of tractors. And suddenly you got a big aggregate.
Oh, tractor knowledge astounds me.
Yeah. I have a son who really likes tractors, and so I've been dragged around. He's only 3 years old, but I seem to have been to more tractor fairs than some tractor buffs. So I know a lot about tractors, but it's a very interesting thing. So only by falling out of patent could lots of people invent from it and actually create the agricultural revolution that we saw through the 40s and 50s.
But so I have a question for you, though, because I think this is, for me, one of the kind of challenges with the kind of promise of the Internet of Everything, is that for you, the...
Ferguson
3-point technique, discovering that not because you owned an object that told you a story that gave you something that you were interested in, that wasn't how you got into that. Your kind of entry point to a piece of history, independent of an object, was the thing that created a very interesting story for you. I wonder if the kind of promise of this idea that every object can tell a story actually is kind of antithetical to this desire of humanity to imagine that when objects in and of themselves leave no mystery, if we're actually going to be quite bored with the idea. Because you look at Antiques Roadshow and curation as a whole, what we seek to find are those spaces in between the stories that we already know. They become lore, they become myth, and we imagine something greater. I think that that's a natural human thing that technology actually could rob us of.
Yeah.
You say that, but I'm thinking that the embedding of stories within objects would enhance that feeling for all the objects that have even more mystery now because we're expecting stories and we don't see them.
Well, I'm just actually being a rabble-rouser and putting out questions.
No, excellent. I love your devil's advocateness. I think more whiskey is in order for that very reason.
That's a really interesting thing. It's sort of like you build the platform for fact, but then people use it for fiction.
Sure.
So suddenly, so just because the platform has arisen, that's it. This is going to be every element of
fiction.
Fiction
or speculation?
Yeah. Actually, fiction. I think it's sort of like you can
archaeology is based on so much imagining what's possible and then hopefully filling in those possibilities later on.
That's very true.
But we ascribe science to that as well, carbon dating. Like, we're still revising carbon dating because we believe that the deposit of certain elements over a period of time turns out to be consistent, but then suddenly someone realizes there was a massive global event and, you know, and Etna spewed a whole bunch of shit into the atmosphere, and suddenly we have to adjust that. So things that we thought were 10,000 years old or 25,000 years old or vice versa, you know, we're still making up the story as we discover it, and we call that science, but in some people's minds it's fiction.
Overall, I think it's kind of, if you imagine the shopping trolley and you go sort of, the problem is, right, if you added data and interest and story to everything in the shopping trolley, nobody would look at any of it.
No.
But what people do is sort of, they will skew to one particular item that they might become really interested in, and then the problem is, how do you know what item they're going to be interested in? Is it going to be coffee? Is it going to be cheese? Is it going to be ham? Is it going
to
be what?
And now we're back to whiskey.
And there's back to whiskey. Is whiskey your thing? So people have a thing, and that is the thing that they're disproportionately interested in. We'll go to the ends of the earth to learn. But then it becomes really hard to differentiate what marketers tend to be, like big audiences, so 1634s or whatever else.
You had to bring marketers into it.
But that's what we'd search for, though. It's, we search, like, I think that's a very interesting thought, is we search for the things which people are disproportionately interested in, and we want to talk to them more about that. But, like, that's a thin sliver, you know? It's like, we want people who care about whether or not they're drinking whiskey from X island, you know, X island. And, you know, for me, which, you know, which rye comes from X place in, you know, in Kentucky or whatever, you know? It's the search for things that are esoteric. And you know, I mean, us kind of, you know, new age people search for those.
The story, in my mind, and I'm sure it does, trumps flavor, because story affects flavor for me.
I'm not willing to accept. I'm not willing to sacrifice one for the other. I think there are a lot of people.
Obviously, flavor has as a serious part in this. But if you give me two things that taste similar, the story is going to attract me to.
Yes, on an even playing field, I'm completely with you. You know, if one is given two equal products and told that this one has a wonderful provenance and this one doesn't, I think 100% of people are going to go for provenance, if only.
But because, why do we want to absorb the story?
That's basic Pepsi challenge, isn't it? It's the same. So just quick reprising the Pepsi challenge. Pepsi put Coke and Pepsi in blank cups, and people prefer Pepsi, and actually if you put them in branded cups, people prefer Coke.
Which is beyond me, because I have a weird kind of anti-Coke mentality. No, I actually have an anti-Coke mentality and go for the potentially the same evil of Pepsi, but think of it as a lesser evil. I don't know why, because I think it was a rebel to drink Pepsi in the days of Pepsi. Let's not take this right down to the shallow brands of Pepsi after you guys are drunk such delicious whiskies. And I believe we are now, unfortunately, have to go to a dinner where
Well, we are actually now late for.
Yeah, but I've seen them serve here in Paris. It's like it's a four hour process, honestly. Honestly, we'll get there just at the right time. Oh. Thank you very much, gentlemen.
Thank you.
And thank you.